for those dairies who had management problems that weren't addressed before going to robotic milking, those didn't go away and maybe even got worse.
A whole new era of communication in the dairy industry is coming. Now you have the brightest minds of the global dairy industry right in your pocket. And what's best? You can listen to all of them while driving to a farm, traveling, or running errands. It's never been this good, and it's never been this simple.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Berg & Schmidt, your partner for improving animal performance. SmaxTech, get insights from inside your cows with SmaxTech for higher herd health and profitability. R Yeast 40, ruminal and intestinal double modulation by ICC Animal Nutrition. Adiseo USA, producers of SmartAmine M and MilkPay.com. Diamond V, because animal health deserves a healthier approach.
Welcome to the Dairy Podcast Show, a weekly podcast where you'll find cutting-edge insights and everything that's working in the global dairy industry.
Welcome back to the Dairy Podcast Show. My name is Barry Bradford from Michigan State University, and today I'm honored to welcome John Gerbitz to the show. John, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So I haven't had the chance to have an episode yet focused on robotic milking systems and how that interfaces with dairy farm management. And John is an expert in that, so I'm excited for this conversation. John, rather than me fumbling through your life history, do you want to give us a little bit of your background and how you got into this space?
Sure. I guess if we go way back, I did not grow up on a farm. Dad did some cash cropping as a hobby. And so when I graduated from UW-Platteville, I bought a group of cows and remodeled a barn that Dad had. And so I was a dairy farmer for 18 years, sold the cows in 2001, actually on October 26, 2001. So 42 years ago, or not 42, 22 years ago today. Okay. That we sold the cows. Get the math right. So sold the cows and worked in AI for 16 years, really started from the very bottom with a Select Sires member co-op as a relief technician and worked my way up through the ranks, some tremendous opportunities, and ended up as a repro consultant and AI trainer and product manager in that line. And then from there, moved to a position at De La Valle. At the time, the De La Valle Dairy Advisory Team was really new and just getting on the road. That's the group that works with the software and the cow management side of things. And so that was my introduction to robotic milking. And I really have found it to be just very fascinating. And so have decided to become more specialized in that area and found my new company called Cow Corner, specializing in herd management for dairies using robotic milking, not necessarily limiting the consulting to things specific directly related to robotic milking. I certainly can work with the whole farm in terms of repro herd health, but all of it is different when we add a robotic milking system into the picture. And so how to use that robotic system software for herd management, as many other robotic dairies do, how to help the rest of the team adapt a robotic milking mindset.
Yeah, that's, I think, one of the most fascinating questions.
R Yeast 40 is a natural biotechnology from ICC designed to boost the health and productivity of animals under challenging production systems. R Yeast 40 performance is supported by an unique processing technology that results in a pure product containing high levels of beta-glucans, MOS, and yeast metabolites. These factors, combined, promote the ruminal and intestinal modulation, helping the animals to reach their full potential.
Maybe 20,000 foot view. I mean, you've had some experience, and you certainly don't need to say anything that indicates which farms you're thinking of, but over the time that you've been working in this space, I'm curious if you've seen some farms that they switched to robotics and after a few years, they were really thriving. And maybe if you've also seen some cases where it didn't work the way they thought it would, and it ended up being sort of a case of regret. Have you seen both ends of the spectrum like that?
That's a good question. And certainly I have seen both sides. And I think in general, those that were doing a lot of things right and had a progressive mindset going in, thinking of one in particular, it was a good bunch of cows and people who paid attention to detail, mm-hmm. asked all of the right questions and listened to the answers through the pre-startup meetings, and just ended up with outstanding results. And on the other hand, for those dairies who had management problems that weren't addressed before going to robotic milking, those didn't go away and maybe even got worse. If you had a problem with lameness, if forage quality wasn't there, if milk quality wasn't there, all of those things are more difficult. And this is not said to talk anybody out of robotic milking, but to help people be realistic as they move into it. It's not a Band-Aid that takes care of the cows for us. It's a way to help good cow people do more with good cows.
So I'm curious, you say if there's a number of major gaps or inadequacies on the management side in a robotic setup, it gets worse. Is that because to make it financially work, you have to trim your workforce and you don't have people to sort of go put out fires? Or is it like, why is it actually worse if you have those existing problems?
Well, I think if we take lameness as an example,
yep.
If in a parlor, the cow's going to get to the parlor when she's lame.
Right.
It may take longer to get her there. It may inconvenience us, and that inconvenience may actually drive us to do something about the problem with that individual cow. In a robot barn, that cow that is lame doesn't come to the robot on her own anymore. She becomes a fetch cow. So she's, if the goal was to milk her three times a day or three and a half or four times a day in the robotic milking barn, she becomes lame. She only gets milked when we fetch her. Now we're down to maybe twice a day for that cow. And so partly because we're less hands-on and expecting cows to do things more themselves, I think mostly because of that, we see these problems. You look at forage quality. Cow's going to get to the parlor, whether we give her high quality forage or not. Certainly, we're limiting in what level of milk production we can reach with poorer quality forages. But in a robot barn, we depend on the rate of passage for that cow to eat a meal, have the forage move through her, get hungry again, and get up and move around the barn again because she's hungry. And we just cannot make that happen as efficiently with high fiber forages.
Okay. So yeah, maybe the way I would think about it is the good and bad thing about a robotic system is we're more hands off, right? So if you have a good system, the cow benefits from that. If she needs a lot of attention because we've got lots of gaps, makes things harder. Huh? Yeah.
And I think along those same lines, training ourselves to, we still need good cowmen who look at a cow and say there's something wrong with this cow.
Yeah.
But we also need good cowmen who look at a report on a computer and say there's something wrong with the cow, and having the discipline to look at that. There's a lot of data that we have. You know, we can have the other sensors that come with it, a lot of the rumination and activity. We look at milk yield, milking frequency. Certainly we've got that new fetch cow. Is it a cow that, if she's never been a fetch cow before and today she's a fetch cow, well, maybe we better look for a health problem that made her a fetch cow. So we have new source of information, but it requires the dedication and know-how to use those sources of information as well.
So again, like kind of staying at the very high level, there, when I get in discussions with people, there's lots of debate about, you know, what's the right model for a robotic farm. So there are different types of robotic systems now, but still the by far dominant one is the box robots, right? And there are people who say, you know, that's appropriate for a 200 cow farm or something like that, and probably smaller. And that's a niche where it fits. There are others who advocate for these multi-thousand cow units so we can make robots work really well. What's your experience there? What do you have thoughts on that debate?
Yeah, a few different directions we can go with that. And I think, first of all, the box robot versus the robotic rotary and what those two systems allow us to do. And my work is focused more on the box robot because it's the cow management that changes. I think that the robotic rotary, the strength in that is that all of the things that we know about managing cows by taking them out of the pen and bringing them back to the pen, all the things that we get to do, we can continue to manage that way with the robotic rotary. And if that's what you want to do, then I think that's the right technology for you. If you want to do some things differently with cow management and manage cows more as individuals and milk each cow with the frequency that she wants to be milked and avoid the time in the holding area and some of those other opportunities that come with managing cows differently, then the box robot can work well for you.
So I think you're exactly right. So that if you're aiming for a difference in cow behavior or the whole way we manage cows, the boxes are the way to go, right? So then do you see that as a good fit for all scales of dairy? Do you think there's like an upper limit where that makes any sense?
I think it's been really interesting over the last 5 years that I've been working with robotic milking to see the increased adaptation by larger herds to things that they're getting out of it. One of the cautions as these systems get really large is we're dealing with more moving parts and more data, and our systems that handle that data have to be, just from a technical perspective, the networks involved, the way information moves from the robot to the computer gets much more sensitive. One of the real strengths with these large herds is the opportunity to manage a group of cows differently. And so if you've got a rotary and the rotary is maxed out, and what's the next step to grow your herd from there? You might add another rotary and double the size of your herd, but that is a difficult thing to grow into, and it changes so many things on your dairy. On the other hand, if you want to grow in a more modular way, you can add 6 robots, 8 robots, 10 robots now and manage your top cows in those robots, learn the technology, and maybe that's the end. Maybe that's how far it went for you. Or maybe you say, hey, this is a good fit. This is what I want my dairy to be, and add another 20 robots. And so it's a very modular thing that we can grow as time goes on. And we see these two different, the talk in the industry is about, we've got the lifestyle customer, and that's really maybe not quite fair. I think they have to be profitable at either end of the spectrum. And if you're not making money, you shouldn't be doing it.
But not like having 20 beef cows, there's a lot of money that flows through a dairy cow, right?
Right. But for those 2 to 4 robot, for the family farm that wants the flexibility, wants the next generation to stay involved and give them something interesting to work with, give them the flexibility to manage their workload. And for the people managing the cows, there's really not a lot difference in the labor, the breeding, the vaccination, the group changes, the calving transition management, that's all still there. And you're still going to do that. But the time of day when you do it is much more flexible. And if you need to get away for a basketball game or a farm meeting, whatever the case might be, it adds an opportunity to do that.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense.
So it fits on both ends of the spectrum.
Yeah. So obviously a part of that question or that conversation is about financials, right? So if you're going to help somebody think through, you know, they're considering moving to robotic milking systems and you help them sort of think through finances, what are the pieces that people maybe overlook? Are there things you've learned there?
I think that the big elephant in the room is always the operating cost. And what is it going to really cost to maintain that robot? What's it going to do to water use? What's it going to do to power use? And what about the repairs and the maintenance kits that have to be done? And to be fair, I think that the milking equipment companies have really tried to have a handle on this, but there's so much variability in the system. How much is the operator going to do themselves, and how much are they going to expect somebody else to do? And that just makes a huge difference from end to end of what it really costs. And so I think that information really has to come from visiting with people who are using the system and understanding what they do themselves and what they expect others to do for them. And then you can have reasonably good information on what the operating cost really is.
Yep. That makes a lot of sense. The other thing that comes up and is an uncertainty, and I'm curious about your perspective on it, is most often when I've seen cash flow projections from these reinvestments, they're putting in at least a 10% bump in milk yield, which I know some farms have certainly seen. That typically takes a year, year and a half before that starts to show up. But you know, if I'm a banker, I'm going to take that with a bit of a grain of salt, right? It's not a guarantee. So how do you think about that? And what have you seen in people that have shifted systems?
I think it depends a little bit on where we're starting and why we are where we are. Mm-hmm. I've worked with farms that you knew in the pre-startup meetings that this was a herd of cows that was waiting for the right environment and the right of opportunity. They were doing all they could do in the environment they had. And you looked at the people involved and you look at the management involved, and you knew production wasn't quite where you want it, but you see those cows, those herds take off, and you come back a year later, and it's just so much fun to go back to those farms and see the progress that they've made. But it kind of goes back to what we were saying earlier, that if the environment isn't limiting, if the milking equipment isn't limiting, then changing those two things is not going to improve the bottom line. That's just the way it is.
Yeah. So I'm trying to think about those factors. So I'm thinking maybe the most extreme might be a herd that's milked 2x, that they're in free stalls that are undersized and old, and where they're building a new barn with not only robotic milking, but better free stalls and that sort of thing. And they're going to go to milking 2.8, 2.9, 3x instead of 2. Is that kind of what you mean?
Yeah. And I think that this is these green site, we give credit to the robots, and the robots deserve some credit. Yeah. But when they move out of that freestall barn that was built in the mid 70s and into a new tunnel vent with sand bedding, there's more than the robot that's making that difference. On the other hand, if you've got a herd with 18% preg rate and you move them into robots, it may get worse, because when you think about poor repro performance, in a robot barn, not only do they tail off on milk production, they lose the will to come to the robot. And it's interesting, a conversation with somebody who visited a robotic dairy in another country where they were using BST. And even those cows where we maintained milk production with BST, the behavior in the barn was still like a lazy late lactation cow, lost the will to come to the robot. And so we have that kind of a double jeopardy with poor repro performance, where not only are we not getting calves and not keeping cows in the peak of lactation, but also we're getting a bunch of fetch cows that we don't need to have.
I have so many questions I could ask you. One that just came to mind because you mentioned that. Let's think about a scenario that doesn't include BST. Typically, later lactation cows are going to self-appoint less frequently, right? And it makes sense, they're making less milk. I think most farms I've seen, they've got a blend of cows across the lactation within a pen so that your total visits is appropriate, because some of your cows are appointing 4 times a day and others 2.2 or whatever. Have you seen people sort of split it out by stage of lactation, and they've got a late lactation pen with 75 cows in it? Or does that just not work with the barn layouts typically?
There's some interesting new things that people are trying and looking at. Historically, it was kind of an industry accepted dogma that we don't like to move cows on robot farms because the change in the social structure disrupts the visits, and that was a problem in low group. But we've seen some farms lately. I'm thinking of one farm in particular where they had built an 8-unit barn and then wanted to see what more milk they could get out of that barn. And so they took, it was a 4-pen barn with 2 robots per pen, and they added a third unit to 3 of the pens. And those were their high groups. And so there's 1 for 2-year-olds and 2 for mature cows, and giving those extra visits to those early lactation cows. And then the third pen that continued to have 2 robots is their late lactation pen. And they have seen some really good things with that. We've got a number of farms in central Wisconsin that have experimented with adding extra robots so that they're no longer maximizing the milk per robot, but they're maximizing the milk from the barn. And it's this question, and I'm kind of getting away from where you originally went, but it kind of fits here, this question of how much can we overcrowd a robot barn? And I think there's a lot we need to learn, but the idea, when you walk into a robot barn and you look around, there's not much going on other than around the robot. And if things are moving the way they should, cows are lying in the stalls or at the bunk or at the robot, and it's evenly distributed between all those areas. And so you don't have all the cows using the stalls at the same time, and it looks like a third of the stalls are empty. And can we use that space? And I think there's some animal welfare considerations that are going to be part of that debate, but some of these guys pushing the envelope and still having stalls available for cows, but adding robot capacity, which both makes use of the stalls, but also makes extra visits available for some of those early lactation cows. And it's, I think the jury is still out on some of that, but we've seen some people have pretty good results with it and watching very carefully where that's going to go.
Yep. Interesting. Yeah, you bring up a point that I hadn't really ever considered until a conversation a few months ago, that because in a robot barn, when cows eat and when they lay down is much more distributed through the day. I mean, they still tend to come up with fresh feed so that you don't completely get rid of the slug of everybody at the bunk. And it is very different than a group that's being moved to the parlor at a specific time, and then everybody wants to eat right after that, right? So I think that does at least raise the question of, can you humanely, increase stocking density a bit? And cool. That's neat that people are working on that. Another thing that has come up in a lot of conversations I've had with people is, and probably less today than 10 years ago when these, installations were new for a lot of people, but lots of farms 6 months in were like, man, I wish I'd thought more about how we're going to breed cows and stuff instead of just, how do we feed and milk? Talk me through that. What do you, first of all, do you see mostly people using lockups or fetch pens, catch pens after the robot, or what do you think is the best system?
That's an interesting question. I think it's, to take a wild guess at the industry, I'm not aware of any statistics. So John Gerbitz's guess would be that maybe a third are using headlocks and 2/3 are using sort pens. I think we can't overlook, outside of that 100%, are those that are managing cows in the stalls. And we do have, especially on the smaller operations where people are more hands-on with the cows, to give shots and breed cows in the stalls happens. In my mind, I was a professional AI technician, and I don't like the idea that this is our default. I want to, clear that ground right away, is that yes, we can do that. And yes, there are people doing it successfully, but I don't think that needs to be our default way to handle cows. It's dangerous. It can be hard on the cows. So I think we need to plan for, if we end up doing that and it works for us, wonderful, but I don't think that should be a plan. The pros and cons of the two different ways of looking at it. And I contributed some to the early thinking at my former employer. If we're going to manage cows in headlocks, we need to be ready to do things quickly. So if it's breeding a few cows, that's, you know, you set at the headlocks and you go and it's quickly. But I think at herd check, the people working with the farm need to know that it's a whole lot bigger problem if there are delays at herd check in a robot barn, because we have shut the robots down while the cows are locked up. And so if I mentioned I was a professional AI technician, and sometimes I would get four call-ins and it would make me late to a chalk herd where cows had been already locked up for me. And yep, that was not a good situation in the parlor, and I was never happy when it happened. Yep. But even more so, those delays are a bigger problem with headlocks. The other issue that we see with headlocks is you mentioned earlier that the slug of feeding brings cows to the headlocks. But in a robot barn, if I'm watching feed dump and I see all the cows to the bunk, we just shut, in any barn, guided flow or free flow, we just shut the barn down, stopped the robots because there are no cows going to the robot anymore because everybody's eating. In the case of a guided flow barn, we may flood the commitment pen and then start bringing eligible cows to the bunk because that's the way the system works. And so we want to avoid that empty bunk that draws cows to the robot, well, or draws cows to the headlocks. That means we aren't really going to expect to get the 90% lockup that we might expect. And so that's another concern. And I don't mean to say we can't manage cows in headlocks. There are, again, a number that do very successfully do their management activities in headlocks. We need to recognize these limitations and have a plan for how we will handle them. The other side of the coin is using a separation pen. And there are pros and cons there as well. I'm thinking of a producer, and I was interviewing some producers on how they're using these systems, and he bragged that he had bred all of his offsinks without going beyond the sort pen. And certainly that reduces the amount of interference that we're not interfering with the cows out in the barn and letting them do their thing and not getting in the way. And that's a good thing. We need, one of the things with the sort pens is we need to plan further ahead. So if a cow is being milked by the system three times a day, but three times a day that she chooses,
right,
where with a parlor, all the cows come back, we can follow the pens around the barn and do our management activities knowing when cows are going to be locked up. And so we can give all of our shots and know when our shots are going to be and know when our breeding is going to be. In the robot barn, if a cow is in heat and we want her in the sort pen, we've got to identify her as much as 8 hours before we want to breed her or give her a shot or whatever the case might be. And so we need to think a little differently in terms of how our shot protocols work. We need to construct those sort pens in a way that while cows are in there, they have access to water and stalls and feed the whole time that they're in there, because if we're going to make it work, we need to be able to leave them in there for an extended period of time. And I think those that have said sort pens didn't work for them are some of the first barns we built, where the sort pens were very small. They had a headlock, but they had no place for the cow to lie down and not a comfortable place. And it doesn't work well if that cow is on an off-sink protocol and needs her shot at 8 o'clock or between 6 and 10 in the morning. And she comes to milk at 4 in the morning and 2 in the afternoon.
Right. Yeah, exactly. What about, you brought up briefly, and I know this can get into heated debates too. What are your thoughts on commitment pens versus free flow?
I'm going to start with the very politically correct answer that has been coached for a long time. And both systems have their strengths and their weaknesses. And I think it really needs to not be dictated by the brand of milking equipment that you chose, but by the management goals that an individual producer has. In our retrofit barns, we need to have a system that fits. You know, it can be very difficult to fit guided flow into some of our retrofit barns, and the existing facility becomes a much bigger concern. If I were going to build a barn today, which is a silly statement because I am not, but I would build a guided flow barn. And I think it goes back to, for me, it's the way my mind works, and it's going to be different for every producer in terms of what they want to manage. My dad was an engineer, and I've always been very comfortable with math, and I can count things that happen at a gate and control things with a gate that works well for my head. In free flow, we're depending much more on nutrition and the balance between the pellet and the bunk. And that is a whole lot harder for me to get a handle on making that work. And so it's really, there is no one size fits all, no right or wrong. I think 5 years ago, there maybe was a feeling in the industry that the top producing herds, and I think there was research that bore this out at the time, that they were getting more milk from free flow barns than they were from guided flow. And I think as we've learned more in the industry and learned more about managing these barns, I don't think that there is a advantage one way or the other. Cost and availability of pellets in a given area might also be a factor. Which way to go with that?
Okay, another, since we're going controversial topics, how, you know, and you worked with De La Valle. Okay, so just be upfront about that. But if I'm a producer and I really don't have any pre-existing feelings about, you know, three major manufacturers of robotic box robots, and then there's actually some other smaller ones too. How do you start thinking through that decision process? Maybe I would start with like a local dealer that I can really trust to be there at midnight if my machine goes down, right? That's a piece of it probably. But how do you think people should think through that?
I think your dealer has to be the number one consideration.
Yeah,
they're with you through thick and thin. And if it's a dealer that you have worked with successfully over time, it's pretty hard to walk away from that dealer. You still have to be, you know, as you said, go out and see a lot of barns. And this is something that I've seen from those who are happy with their system. They did a lot of homework. They saw a lot of barns. And there are strengths and weaknesses to each. There's different ways of looking at different things. It's been interesting for me as I no longer have the bias that I had a few months ago, to learn from all sides and not see one as good and the other as bad, but to see them each having their own strengths and weaknesses. And so look at the prep. Different robots prep in different ways. Which one are you comfortable with? Look at the software. You're going to live in that software, and each does different things. One does different things better than the other. You know, there are different ways that we enter sorts and different ways that we create reports and different ways that information is prioritized in the software. And so we need to look at all those things. And again, the dealer is number one. Look at a lot of farms and make sure that you're comfortable with what you're getting in terms of how each system works.
Okay, so we've got to start closing this down. We could go on for hours, I'm sure. But I'm curious if somebody came to you and said, you know, I've never been around robotic milking. I'm interested. What's like the one first thing that you want in their head? What's something you wish everybody knew before they jumped into robotic systems?
Yeah, I think somebody else said this, and I'm borrowing it from them, but I think that robotic milking is for cow people who want to do more with their cows and manage their cows in a different way. And people who are looking at robotic milking to avoid spending time in the barn are probably not going to be happy with the technology. That it is still a very hands-on thing. It gives us flexibility, gives us some new way to manage cows. But if you're doing it to get away from the cows, you're going to be disappointed.
That's a really good takeaway. Okay.
It's time for our famous three.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Natural Biologics delivers cost-effective solutions to improve health and productivity, helping conquer the rumen health and immunity challenges your animals face.
Exalit, a novel product for the management of hypocalcemia. It's uncomplicated excellence. Evonik Animal Nutrition, we are sciencing the global food challenge. DSM Firmenich, mycotoxins can threaten feed and cattle performance. DSM Firmenich offers a portfolio of solutions to help mitigate the impact of mycotoxins in your feed. Typical fresh cow incidence of clinical hypocalcemia is 3 to 6%, while subclinical hypocalcemia affects 50% or more mature cows. Based on cutting-edge research, Exalit offers a new approach that is build effective and the ZDUs. For more information, visit www.protecta.com.
All right. Well, we've got three questions to grill you with that we ask every single guest. So we're not going to let you off the hook. So first of all, do you have a favorite dairy-related book or resource that you turn to?
I think my two go-to resources would be Progressive Dairy and Hordes Dairyman, and I try to read those as regularly as I can. Beyond that, I think it's conferences and it's learning from dairymen and spending time on farms and in management meetings.
Good. What about a little more broadly, your favorite book or resource outside of agriculture?
Well, I think that the Bible has to be number one. But I think a distant second, one of my favorites is Good to Great by Jim Collins. If you're not familiar with the book, he compares companies that went from mediocre performance to great performance and compares them to companies that did not make that improvement. And the principles that he identifies work not only for corporations, but for people, organizations, and certainly for dairy farms.
And then lastly, in your opinion, what sets successful dairy professionals apart from those who are less successful?
I think it's a vision, and knowing where they need to be down the road. I look at people who started milking at the same time I did, and now they're milking 5,000 cows and I'm doing this. And I was looking at what happens a week from now, and they were looking at what happens 10 years from now. And I'm not unhappy with where I ended up, but there's a good reason why they're milking 5,000 cows and I'm not.
Well, yeah, maybe you migrated into what your calling is, right? So
exactly. Yep. The Lord put me here and this is where I belong and I'm happy with it. But I think successful dairymen need a planning horizon, need to know where they want to be 5 years from now, 10 yep. years from now.
Yeah, that's good. And part of that vision probably too is having a bigger sense of mission than just surviving on the farm, right?
Yes.
Feeling like it's a calling, I guess. Yeah.
Yep.
Good thoughts. Well, John, I really enjoyed this conversation. Thanks for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me. Enjoyed it.
So this has been another episode of the Dairy Podcast Show. And if you haven't subscribed yet, if you want to hear more great content like this conversation, subscribe today. And we'll see you next time.
Looking to elevate your brand and captivate audiences through the power of podcasting? Look no further. Introducing the custom podcast brought to you by Wisemetics, where we take care of the behind the scenes so that you can focus on what truly matters. Podcasting has become an invaluable tool for brand awareness, but let's face it, putting it into practice can be a daunting task. It's incredibly time consuming and requires technical know-how. But don't worry, we've got you covered. With our experienced team at the helm, we'll handle the operational aspects so you can channel your energy into what your company does best. Are you ready to unleash the podcasting potential of your company? Schedule a call with one of our specialists today at the link in the bottom of this episode. You'll also receive a free podcast strategy consult tailored to the unique needs and goals of your business.